Friends, as the first speaker pointed out, the subject of our lecture today is you are not alone. Of course, human beings, they require the company of other human beings, and yet we find today, as was pointed out by the first speaker, that there's one great malady from which modern man suffers is loneliness. And this solace, this message, you are not alone, is in a way a reminder to all those who are feeling lonely, and also at the same time, and in fact you can see there are only two sides of the same coin, it is also a message and a reminder to all those who assert their independence quite foolishly. As the very first quotation in your handouts, in your hand says, this is something Mr. Judge writes about Americans. Imagine, somewhere in the 1880s, he is writing and saying, looking at their attitude of independence and assertion of freedom, he says, I'm tired of all those people who gave and gave and are, excuse me, so Americanly independent, as if men were ever independent of each other. Now, this is a reminder even to all of these people who are asserting independence, and we will see a lot about it. Because even if you are independent, say self-dependent in many ways, maybe physically and otherwise, or financially, but there is that deep-seated need in each and every one of us to share, sharing our disappointments, frustrations, achievements and whatnot. And when that sharing, that need for sharing is not fulfilled, it finds its outlet in some other way, in some very weird way, like the story by Maxim Gorky is called Her Lover. It's a story about a woman of loose morals who approaches a college student once with a request that, please write a letter to a lover, I'll dictate it. So he writes that. After a few days, she comes back again to the student, and now with a very queer request to write down a letter from her lover to herself, also dictated by her. So the student asks that, what is this? And then in the conversation he discovers, and she confesses, that really there existed no lover. She had invented this lover, and she said that it is this exchange of letters with this imaginary person which made life bearable. And the student felt really pained and ashamed that not 3 yards away from him there lived this creature who had no one to call her home, no one to really speak to her with affection. Probably the situation is not as bad as that today, but something very similar is to be seen even these days. You see, therefore, even before we approach this subject philosophically, let's approach it psychologically and sociologically, because we do find that this situation has arisen today of feeling lonely, as it were, so that we need to remind and give that solace to people who are not alone is actually of our own making. As Mr. Jack says, that in America, these people, they assert their freedom. But you also find the same thing happening in the East. You also find the same thing happening in the younger generation. Admirable as it is that in the younger generation you see a lot of confidence, you see a lot of independence, but at the same time they say, I want my space. They want their space, so parents, if they say something, it's not really looked upon in the right light, it is interference. If the parents comment on the dress code or staying away outside the home for a long time in the night or erratic eating and sleeping habits, that's not tolerated. And therefore at a very, very young age, you find so many of them, they start earning and become financially independent, they move out of the house and rent a home, rent a place somewhere, they stay, but immediately it is seen. There are articles after articles. You read in newspapers, you read in the magazines that they are not emotionally and mentally equipped to really tackle this state of remaining alone. Though you may be financially independent, but immediately one will engage in series of casual affairs, or it may be that there is deep depression or some psychological disorder, or there is always this need to be connected through internet, through Facebook, Twitter, mobile, or what not. Now, why has this state come about? Because we also find, and this is something the student has heard from so many young people who say that, you know, today, that thing about having a bosom friend, it's a thing of past. You can't have a close friend with whom you can open up, tell about your deepest secrets or unburden yourself. It's likely to be misused. It's likely to be, well, not taken properly. They'll take advantage of you and so on and so forth. So, and again we have read articles where they say that yes, you don't have, so many of them they say they don't have any close friend as such. And therefore, the very human relationship we can see has undergone a radical change. You can't open up to your family, you don't feel close enough with them. You can't open up to a friend because there is no close friend. And therefore, go a step further and you find that people have pets. And they say they love their pets more than they love human beings. Because, well, pets don't demand anything of you. You see, they are not demanding at all. There is no fear of being rejected by a pet. And so go a step further and you have something very, very abnormal, which they call as a psychological disorder, which is termed as objectum sexual. So people actually are having a deep intimate relationship with not other people, but deep intimate relationship with inanimate objects. The first time the student read, she was quite shocked that they will be marrying their own pillows, their computers, they are married to the plants, to the dolls. So even after marriage, in one case it was said that this young man, in the middle of night, he would go and talk to his plant. What happened in the office and what does he plan to do next day and so on. So we can see that we are, because of some rejection in a relationship, because you are let down, because your trust is broken, you have turned around completely and, as it were, completely shown your back to human relations. Now this will not do. So we can see that actually a lot of it that we see today in the name of loneliness is made by ourselves. We are ourselves responsible for the warped human relationship which we have created. And this is not in India, it is not just in the younger generation, as again in the one of the articles they write, it's a, in fact a book review on a book called Lonely American, Drifting Apart in 21st Century. And the author points out the same thing once again, that now you find lots of Americans saying they don't have any close friends to whom they can open up. One out of four households in America will have only one person and not more. And the author actually gets at the root of it and says that it's because of a kind of a divided desire in us. On the one hand, we have the desire to assert our freedom. And on the other hand, you have this deep-seated desire also to connect with other people. And we are not able to find the balance. In fact, as he goes on to write, lots of Americans, they passionately defend their right and their desire to have their freedom. In the process, they will not even admit that now they are feeling a void within. You see, and you try to fill up the void by drugs, drinks, going shopping, get all the gadgets. But that is not really something which is going to fill up the void. And this we know very well. It's not just abroad, not just in India. Everywhere we see that this void is not going to be filled up. That which we are trying to, as it were, fill up by having chats and kind of talking with web cameras and all that. A heart-to-heart talk with a friend is something which we really need. And we are really turning our back. The author therefore says that there is a very simple thing to do. Just look at your choices. What little choices you make, and if you can bring about a change there, you will see that you can avert a lot of this loneliness. For instance, he points out that it's your choice whether to order for a thing over the phone, over the internet, or actually go to a shop and therefore have interaction with a shopkeeper and meet some people on the way. and thus have a human interaction. It's up to you when the phone is ringing to pick it up or allow it to go on ringing till it goes on voicemail, and so then alarm say you pick up and hear a recorded message. It's up to you to once in a while ring up a friend and say, come, chalo, let's spend time together, or lazily sit and push in a DVD and watch some movie or listen to music, but just remain to yourself. He says these are cumulative decisions. These are small, small things, but they add up. And finally, you feel that you have taken a step, a little step back from others, and others have taken a little step back from you, and you feel at the end of it left out. So, one thing is that you go more than halfway seeking people. It's not as if people are going to come seeking for you. They may and they may not. But it's up to you to remain connected. It's not when you need them, but just generally have a very healthy, normal human relationship, which is what is lacking today. And that's what we need to do. Secondly, what we can do is, if nothing else, let's seek those who need other people. As Albert Schweitzer at one place says, that go and find out. There are lots of people who are in need of help. A blind man who wants a book to be read to him, go. Go and read a book to him. There will be somebody else who wants a sympathetic ear. Please be there, available for him. Just try and find out some such work through which you can remain engaged. That's yet another way of doing things. But we know that this is just at a social, psychological level, mending our ways. In fact, we have really forgotten how to share things. People say that, remember those good old days. The problem now is that because everybody is able to buy all the gadgets, you go even to slum area and in that jhopadpatti they will have a TV, a mobile phone, a fridge. So in one sense, there is neither inclination nor a need to share. You have forgotten to share and care. Can you ever go back and remember the days when, at least the student remembers, that in the whole building probably one or two people will have television, and half the building will crowd there and we'll still sit huddled together watching Ramayana episode or Mahabharata episode or watching Wimbledon. And whether the person liked it or not, we are there to watch it. So this was the purest happy moments togetherness. Why we are elaborating? Because it's our very lifestyle which has really alienated us. Before we know, we've really alienated ourselves because we think we don't really require anybody. And this is really the problem. So that in America now, what they do is that 15, 20 people, they come together and they are having something called cooperative housework. So these 15 people together will make a home. They will buy a large area. They'll live together and each one will be allotted something of the managing of the house. Now, aren't we going back to that system which we have abolished, the joint family system? We've broken it down. There is no joint family system. But by having this cooperative household, you are going back there. In a way, each one has his share in managing the household. And you want, because you want companionship. We've even broken the nuclear family, come to think of it. Today, we prefer a kind of a living relationship, you see. Because we are the people who want to eat the cake and have it too. You want human companionship, but with no strings attached. You don't want any responsibility, so that after 10 years of staying together, you one fine day you decide it's not going to work out, you can walk out. You walk out with no responsibility. So, how much the human relationship has undergone change? And this is what we need to rethink one more time, so that half of this problem of loneliness will be sorted out. Because if you will just, really, if you take the stock of it, how many people in the earlier days complained of loneliness? I don't think even 1% or 2% may be there. And today, I think quite a large number of people are suffering from it. But having seen this side, we have to also take into account that whether we like it or not, sooner or later, life may bring us to a point where we have to face this very loneliness. You may be not guilty of any of these things. Maybe you've really cared for your family, cared for your friends, and yet we do find, and that's what we do see these days, that one by one, your dear and dear ones are taken away from you. Some of them get separated because they have settled abroad. And then you heavily lean on some sort of a substitute. Like you will take to gardening, pot culturing, reading books, or maybe listening to music, painting and whatnot. Even these props, these supports are taken away by life, because probably you will develop arthritis, probably there will be hearing loss, there will be problem in seeing, and as a result you are absolutely left to yourself. Now you are left with only two things, two choices as it were. Choose between the two things. One, to slip into apathy and keep complaining that you are alone and lonely, or just get up and say, I'm not alone, because there is that in me which is my companion. So there is that which is within us, which is the greatest companion. Now this may sound really totally out of place, because have we really had a first hand experience of these companion within? But the philosophical basis and the guarantee with which, and the kind of force with which we are saying that you are not alone, is just based on that. That there is something in you which is, as in the Gita, Sri Krishna says, I am the goal, the comforter, the witness, the asylum and the friend. But have we had ever the experience of this comforter, the asylum and the friend within? Very few of us can say that we have had. We have not had this experience. And it is something which is going to come very, very gradually. Of course, one of the things, or rather the first steps to dealing with this situation, which is inevitable, no matter what you do, sometimes even without your knowing, you are just there all alone, in the sense of not having any of your relations or friends around you. What are you going to do? To deal with that, the first thing which we are supposed to do is cultivate what philosophy would say, detached attachment. A detached attachment. That while you are surrounded by your near and dear ones, don't get so completely identified with them and be attached to them that a little separation becomes difficult. But nor should you be so completely apathetic to human beings. So detached attachment is what we need to create, cultivate. And that is again something not so easy, as in this book by William Dalrymple, Nine Lives, the Search of a Sacred in Modern India. In the very first chapter, I think he is interviewing a Jaina nun, and this Jaina nun confesses to him that as Jains, we are supposed to be cultivating detachment and a certain amount of indifference to all the worldly things. And yet, I must confess that I miserably failed there, because I, who could leave behind my family without a second glance and underwent what they call as Diksha and initiation and became the Jaina nun, miserably wept when my companion nun died. And how could I not? I mean, look at that. Someone who has lived a spiritual life says, how could I not cry and miss her when I spent 20 years with her, 20 years sharing everything, doing everything together, moving around together. How could I not miss? This is the crux. That because we as human beings are always looking for support, guidance, appreciation, love outside of ourselves. Whether it is a family member or whether it is a friend, it's always outside. Have we really tried to look within and try and find out what my inner self has to say? First of all, are we really aware of that inner self? And we'll come to that a little later. But therefore, the first step probably would be not straight away try and make a connection with your inner nature, but first step would be, let's try to be a little impersonal when we live. Let's try to be little self-dependent as we live. And this is really a sage advice, which I think fourth or fifth quotation in the first portion, Mr. Crosby is giving us. He says, never ask another to do for you what you can do for yourself. Know where your things are and get them for yourself when you need them. Do for others all you can in a nice way, but do not expect others to do for you. You are valuable only when you are helpful, not when you require help. Now that's very shocking. You do something for someone and you expect that next time I need her, she'll be there. I only have to ring her up and she will be there. No, please, try and forget that. Do for others what you can, but don't expect them. And once that you have let go of that expectation from your family or your friends, then it will not be so shocking, it will not be so shattering and disappointing if others are not around to stand by you. So, this is something which is very simple. We can always try to do this step by step. Finding your own things, doing your own things, and then always being ready to help another. You see, that's where actually the philosophical point lies. Because some of them can become very self-dependent but very rigid. I mean, they don't care about anybody. No, not that. You do your things, but always be ready to help another. Secondly, and again, I think this is a very simple, very, very subtle psychological point on which he is hit upon. He says, apart from what we might call inordinate self-assertion, personality has small and seemingly harmless methods of keeping itself in evidence, such as telling others in the home what one is going to do in regard to matters that are not necessary to communicate. See our world today. See families today. What happens? You find as soon as you get up, in certain families you see as they get up, they brush their teeth and they are all trying to tell each other what they are going to do. What dress they are going to wear, where is my coffee, is my this thing iron, okay, those things are fine. But something or the other, you are just talking and telling each other. Go to office, and this student has been a witness to the group of ladies, whether at lunch or otherwise, as soon as there is free time, they start telling. You know, as if they are narrating the entire dinacharya, all that happened in the day. From the time they went home to the time they came back to office, they have to tell everything. I got up in the morning, I brushed my teeth, my husband wanted the towel, and you know, he found sugar less in the coffee. Are these the things which we necessarily have to tell our friends? But no, we want to. There is as it were a compulsive need to share things. This may sound trifling, this may sound harsh to some people. But aren't we supposed to? But no. If you really want to reach that point wherein you can say, yes, I am not alone, and these are the small, small things wherein you can check yourself. Not have that compulsive need to tell every little thing to people in the office or even while coming back, people at home. Because then you will come gradually to a point, and that's the next point, where when there is some trouble in your life, when there is pain in your life, when there is pleasure in your life, and it may so happen that there is no one around to share, but you will then not feel the need. You will not feel shattered. You can manage your own problems. You can manage your own pain. You can manage even without telling another about the gold medal which you may have got. You know, there is a deep need to share. So there is such a balance which is required. On the one hand, don't become so cold and dry as to not share. But don't also become so dependent to share things with other people. So there, and this is of course a spiritual requirement we are talking about. Do your crying and sighing within you. If you cannot receive the small events of life and their meanings without crying them out to all the world, think you that you are fitted to be trusted with the mysteries? So, crying and sighing must be done within you without wanting, having that compulsive need to share with another person. And we can see that therefore what is left is that you have to build that self-dependence by turning within yourself. And very interestingly, in Buddha's Eightfold Path, we are told there are all the other steps which we won't get into, but the second last step is something which is called Sammapsati or Samyak Spruti, which actually we might say it is right remembering, perfect remembering, or rather it is translated as perfect mindfulness or perfect awareness. There's lots of emphasis put in Buddhism on perfect awareness. Becoming aware of your thoughts, becoming aware of your feelings, becoming aware of other people's feelings and their needs. But above all, what is this Sammapsati or Samyak Spruti all about? becoming aware of who you really are. And that is why the author of Light of Asia, Sir Edwin Arnold, the book is there on the book table, he says, he translates this perfect awareness as right loneliness. There is something called right loneliness. It's not that you are feeling lonely, but you are perfectly happy in solitude. As Thoreau used to say, that I am happy to be alone. I have never found a companion more companionable than solitude. In fact, he used to go for 1 or 2 months in the forest, build a cabin for himself and live there. There'd be not a single creature seen inside, but he would be perfectly happy being and living in that cabin completely on his own. Not only just physically and otherwise, but just on his own. And so he says there is no companion, more companionable than solitude. Now, this is what is right loneliness. And that right loneliness comes when you become aware of your real nature. The problem is we are not aware of our real nature, who we are. So, one of the things which we are asked to do is periodically, in a day, set apart a little time, half an hour for studying some scriptures, and also a little time should be spent in reflecting upon the scriptures. Just be with yourself. 10 to 15 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes. Some people can't, you know. Some people immediately reach out for a phone, switch on television. They are very restless if they are alone for 10 to 15 minutes. But we are told that deliberately take out this time. It could be while traveling on train that you could completely be silently turning within yourself and try and make a connection with that, the goal, the comforter, the divine witness which is within you. Now, one of the meditations which is suggested by Mr. Judge in one of the letters is, he says, think upon getting up in the morning, then upon going to sleep, as many times as you can. I am not the body, I am not the mind, I am not my emotions, I am not my ideas, I am that. That is a complete kind of withdrawal from all those things with which we identify ourselves. You know? Some of us are too much identified with our looks. Some may be too much identified with the ideas, with our education, with the way we speak, God knows what. But I am not any of these things, but I am that. Not just say it, but actually try to feel it. Just like when there is a lot of headache, but you can ignore it and continue to solve your mathematical problem or whatever work in hand is there. Temporarily you have detached yourself from your body. Without really knowing it, you have detached. When someone insults you and you don't react, you have detached yourself temporarily from your, whatever was the remark, that you are very harsh or you are dishonest. You have detached yourself, so you don't react, you are not ruffled. So, like that, we have to realize that you are not any aspects of your personality, but you are that. If we can really feel this, then again, we will not have the problem of that loneliness. Then that right loneliness, right aloneness is what we are heading towards. But more than that, there has to be actually the realization of the presence of the divinity within you. Who speaks to you, who is guiding you, which we generally term as still small voice, the voice of conscience. Have we ever tried to listen to this voice? Have we ever put our propositions before this voice within and say, what should I do in this? Instead of consulting a lawyer or consulting your mother or your friend, have we ever tried and said, just please guide me, what should I do in this matter? If we do it, chances are that, and of course, if you are very honest and sincere, you are guided. And this voice, we are told, we are assured and promised, it speaks louder and louder the more you consult this voice. But the first thing is to affirm the presence. Some of us, people like Richard Dawkins, will say there is no God. The God delusion is what people are talking about today. If you don't even believe in God, then there is a question of feeling the presence of that divinity within you. You have to first believe. So, The kind of faith we have must be a firm faith. You know, one of the things which is said in Patanjali's Yoga Aphorisms regarding the means of concentration is, it is tapa, swadhyaya and ishvara pranidhana. Tapa is mortification, swadhyaya is self-study and ishvara pranidhana. Ishvara pranidhana means surrendering yourself to the divinity. Now, it's not therefore just question of now and then retreating within you in silence, but all through life, in everything you do, are you aware of the presence of that divinity? Are you acting in such a way that I've done my best, I leave the results to the God? That would be really surrendering. The element of surrendering to the God, Ishvara Pranidhana. Only then will you feel the closeness, that whatever happens, it's not something which happens suddenly to Mirabai or Narsi Mehta. You know, there are these Gujarati saint poets, Narsi Mehta and all. We are told that they were never worried. You see, their daughter was to be married and we are not even a rupee actually to give to the opposite party. And we are, he was having complete faith that his Krishna will take care. And sure enough, everything that was required for the marriage was provided for. Are we having that kind of a faith? We don't. Even after having done our best, we are anxious till the result comes. So, these are various different ways in which we have to be aware that you are not alone. There is that greater power working in everything. And also there is something nearer home, and that is what Kiyosvi talks about as the masters of wisdom. The masters of wisdom, they are not the figures of straw. They are not someone created out of the imagination of the H.P. Blavatsky who brought the message of Theosophy. They are living facts. And in fact, we are told, if communion with your divine nature is difficult, seek then the bridge, the masters. Again and again and again in Theosophy, we have been told that think of a master as a living man within you. It's as if he lives within you. Like Ramananda, you know, his father Hiranyakashipu, when he was going against him and saying that God is everywhere, and when he was challenged, is your God in this pillar? And he said, yes. With complete faith, he said that God is in that pillar, and the pillar broke and the God came out of it. So are we having that faith when Mr. Jack says, they are in everything in life, in every phase of your changing days and years, the masters are there. To every sincere student, there is an invisible escort. Whether you hear them or not, whether you see them or not, the holy light and the holy power is shining in your hour of spiritual aspiration and darkness. Now, these are all the words of solace and assurance which we are given. But how much are we living up to it? Is Master of Wisdom a living fact for us? Or is it some figure who is far, far away from us? So, it's up to us to draw near to them. And how do we draw near to them? One of the things which is said is that when you forget yourself and help others, you kindle in your heart what is called as Tathagata light. Just like a mountaineer from his mountain peak, when he looks down, everything may be down, but if there is one candle lighted, he can see. So also, if you are the kind of human being who is ready to forget himself and take every opportunity of helping others, then you have lighted up the Tathagata light. And then that will be seen by the master from wherever he is. We are also told, look at that quotation which is there, I think on the second side of the page, the second quotation, which says, the most intelligent being in the universe, man, has never been then without a friend, but has a line of elder brothers who continually watch over the progress of the less progressed, preserve the knowledge gained through eons of trial and experience, and continually seek for the opportunities of drawing developing intelligence of the race to consider the great truths concerning the destiny of the soul. So here they are. You are not alone in your endeavor. They are all the time there. Not only have they preserved the knowledge, but they will be there hinting, dropping hints as to what to do and what not to do. But you have to really open up. As they say, the voice of the masters is always in the world, but you have to attune your ears to that voice. And not attune your ears to the din of the marketplace, as they say. Our ears are never attuned to that voice of the masters, which is pervading the whole world. So this is a solace. Plus, we are told that they are remaining in the invisible. invisible atmosphere, they are charging the atmosphere with entities powerful for good alone, that it is but for them, humanity would undergo much greater suffering and sorrow than what it is, because it is these beings who feel that they are one with humanity, and therefore they can take upon themselves some of the collective karma of humanity, not individual karma, but collective karma of humanity, of the wrong kind, of which we would bear otherwise the consequences. They take it upon themselves. As Jesus, they say, he died on the cross. He died on the cross, and therefore our sins are not washed off. That is not the right understanding. But when he died on the cross, some of the collective karma of humanity was taken upon himself by him. So there is again the great solace that you are not alone. But won't we then emulate them? As we said, this "you are not alone" is a reminder to all of us who may feel that, oh, I'm alone, and therefore I can live the way I want to. I can do what I want. And as the other day we were having a question on the Friday class, that I may think about something of hitting someone or even killing someone, but so long as I don't kill, am I really responsible karmically? And the answer is yes. Because as the Master of Wisdom says, nature has linked her empire together by subtle threads of magnetic sympathy. And there is a correlation between the man and a star, which is very well put by Francis Thompson, who says, all things by immortal power, near or far, hiddenly to each other linked are. That thou canst not stir a flower without troubling of a star. You stir a flower here and something happens of a star. And you would say, that's ridiculous. But no. Theosophy says that we are all connected on the inner mental plane of our being by sympathetic ties. Like you have two tuning forks, and if you just bang one of them and it starts vibrating, the other one in the vicinity will also begin to vibrate in unison. Like that, there are sympathetic ties which are really binding us together, and therefore let's not make a mistake of thinking that I'm only thinking. No. You can corrupt the character of another person through your thoughts. I mean, something symbolically to the student it occurs is conveyed through the story or the anecdote. There was a grocer once, and he used to always keep faulty scales. In fact, he had two of the faulty scales. So if one broke down, he can use another. Now, as it so happened, there was a vegetable vendor who was not so far away from his shop selling vegetables. Now he knew that this grocer has two scales, so he approached once when he broke his scale, can you lend me yours? So he was given. Now 2-3 days later, the grocer's wife went to buy vegetables, and she bought vegetables from this vegetable vendor, came home, and immediately she started complaining. You know, this man, he started cheating now. Today I found the vegetable is distinctly less than what he used to give before. The grocer said, which vegetable vendor? Oh, the one who sits this place. Then the husband had to confess that, you know, he's borrowed our scales and we use faulty scales. So in a way, the simple message is, by what measure you beat unto another, by that same measure it will be measured unto you, is one thing. But on a subtle scale, what does it mean? It implies that unknowingly to yourself, you can give an impulse to another to do something wrong. You see, you struggle here not to take bribe. Your thought is impressed in what Theosophy calls as astral light. It is a huge universal canvas that we talk about. Your thought is impressed. Another man, maybe thousands of miles away, maybe in America, is also struggling not to take bribe. Probably he will attract your thought and he will be helped to resist the temptation, or vice versa. It could be the other way around. If you give in to the temptation, you have impressed some other kind of thought, and another man will catch that thought and he will be slipping down by your impulse. Did we ever think about this? That we are subtly created, connected. Though we may be in the separate physical bodies as we see. Look, I think the words of Mr. Jaj are very telling. He says, does the man of virtue, by admitting a material or sensual thought into his mind, even though he expel it, sends it forth to swell the evil impulses of the man of vice, from whom he imagines himself separated by a vile tongue, and to whom he may have just given a fresh impulse to sin? Many men are like sponges, porous and bibulous, you know. Some of them, they do not have a mind of their own, as they say. Anyone says something, they'll do it. And unknowingly to themselves, they are continually attracting these thoughts to themselves. And especially we all do attract these thoughts and act upon them in our weaker moments. That's what he's saying here. We attract what we love, and we may derive a greater strength from the vitality of thoughts infused from without than from those self-produced within us at a time when our nervous vitality is exhausted. It is a solemn thought, this, of our responsibility for the impulse of another. We live in one another, and our widely different deeds have often common source. So, secondly, they do talk about, writers today talk about what is known as collective psyche of humanity. It's a very similar idea of what we told now, collective psyche. And they say that therefore if you have a negative thought, you, by law of resonance, you will be triggering and feeding a negative quality in another person, because each one of us has got germs of every bad quality and every good quality in us. Though we may not manifest it, the germs are there. And if we do it, then we give a kind of impulse to another. And Mr. Crosby says that therefore, if you are depressed, your depression will go a long way in depressing your loved ones in the family. And therefore, it is always good to assume a cheerful attitude and cultivate oneself, in oneself, the feeling of confidence and endeavor to impart it to our nearest. This is the thing. More than that, we are told your karma is inextricably interwoven with the karma of whole humanity. The sin and shame of the world are your sin and shame. If there is an Ajmal Kasab, he is not an isolated being. The idea is you must have had a hand in making him what it is. It's very shocking. But it's not for one life that we are together. Life after life after life, we have all lived together, come together. And therefore, you won't find yourself in a place where you are not karmically connected. So, it's not right for you to walk out of the house saying that my father earns money by unfair means. It's not right for you to complain that Indian government is corrupt, the officials are corrupt, there is a lot of pollution in Bombay, so on and so forth. Do something to amend it, because you, if you are born in India and in Mumbai, it shows that you must have had a hand in making it what it is now, maybe in this life or maybe in some past life. So this is the whole concept of collective karma. By means of this collective karma, you also enjoy amenities, because you did not really design the transport system, you did not invent a mobile phone, you did not invent so many amenities which are there, and yet you enjoy. So this is collectivity. You are not alone. You are collected, and you therefore reap the good and the bad effects collectively. So let's not really grip about them. I think we'll have to stop here. And with the thought that our topic is something like, the student was reminded of that sentence in the Upanishads where they say, the guru is first supposed to tell the chela, tatakvam asi, thou art that. And it is for the chela then to realize, aham brahmosmi, I am very dumb. So, the scriptures are saying, you are not alone, because there is your higher self, there is your divine nature, there are the masters, there are the sages, but it is up to you to come to the stage and be able to say, yes, I am not alone. Time is there for asking questions.
I have a question. Madam, you said that if you are depressed, people around you are depressed. If you are cheerful, people around you are cheerful. That's what I get up for this.
Yeah.
Well, in counseling, where a person is depressed, psychology says that through counseling, that person shares his thought with somebody else and it feels like. So, if on one hand, if you say you are sharing your depression with someone, the people around you will get depressed. But at the same time, you also hear the psychologist say that you counsel someone, the person shares his or his depression, he feels light about it.
Sharing is one thing. Is there a question? Is something more coming?
No.
But okay. So the question is about if you are depressed, others become depressed. And counseling says, but then if you are depressed, they say you should share your depression with the counselor and you feel lighter. Yes, that's a fact. It's not saying that this will not happen. After all, if you are in pain, if you are depressed, if you are disappointed, you do share it with another, and they use in a psychology this thing, a term called catharsis, you know, taking it off your chest. That's in fact a very definite psychological term. Now, that we are not denying. Here what it says is that if you continually, without sharing with anyone, continually just tend to remain in a depressed mood, then other people, unknowingly to themselves, will tend to also become a little gloomy. Mind you, it doesn't become that the whole family will become a family of depressed people. It's not saying that. Because there is one people who is depressed, the whole family will not get into depression. But a little bit of gloom will be there. Now, this we would have all experienced. You know, if you just enter the room where somebody would have had quarrel and they have gone, you are the next person to enter the room. What happens? You feel something uncomfortable. There are certain vibrations which you absorb. You absorb those vibrations because these are all magnetic vibrations which we are throwing off back and forth. So this is just trying to show that in very, very subtle way, again, it's not saying that therefore if I take a bribe, tomorrow my neighbor will also begin to take bribe and my third neighbor will also begin to take bribe. It's not that fast. But a little difference this way or a little difference that way it is going to make. But it is quite another thing if you actually go and share it. You go and share what you feel, why you feel down, you talk it out. And of course, let us also remember that the counselor is a different person. He is not just passively moving around you. He or she is someone who is well equipped to deal with such a situation. And therefore he knows the methods, the ways of bringing you out of that depression. Otherwise, nobody will be able to help another person. So if there is someone who is strong enough, he is not likely to get depressed because you go in his presence. Someone who is strong enough can, in fact, if it is a milder kind of disappointment or depression, you come back cheered, as they say, you know. You go in company of that person, they say, oh, his laughter is contagious. His optimism is contagious. We do talk about that. So your disappointment and your depression is going to be counteracted by his optimism, which is far greater than your disappointment. He can fill you up with a lot of optimism, can fill you up with a lot of cheer. That can also happen. There is always counterbalancing of the feelings which may take place. But generally, if you are not on your guard, and if there is a person who is depressed, then you also tend to, as it were, feel a bit gloomy. You've gone and meet someone who is very depressed, and if you are not used to handling it, and you just give yourself passively to his sorrow, you start crying and you are depressed also. This happens. But if you don't passively give yourself, but actively try and be in sympathy, quite the reverse can happen. You are in command of yourself, and yet you are able to help him and then comfort him. This is what they say, you know, sympathy. They say that means to put yourself in shoes of another. And they also caution you that you have to wear the shoes of another, actually keep them on for some time to know how he feels. But please, remove them also quickly. Otherwise, if you keep them on for a very long time, you yourself are going to be in that same state. So there are these subtleties about human nature which we have to understand. It's simply absorbing the vibrations, the magnetic vibrations, which we throw around us and which we absorb from each other. This is the whole idea. I hope it solves the...
Yes, that means it's not a general rule that a person who's depressed or cheerful, the opposite person will also similarly get affected by the
depression. The guarantee is not zero.
It depends upon the trait of the other person.
State
if how strong or weak that person is, am I right?
Yes, but to a certain extent it will make a difference.
It will make a difference.
It will make a difference. It will make a difference, but to a certain extent. As we said, if you are not too disappointed, perhaps the other man can cheer you up completely. But if you are too much disappointed, nothing helps. You know, for some people they say, just let me be.
not to talk to anyone. This is my way of getting over my disappointment. I mean, we have come across people who say that. They don't want anybody to talk to, they don't want anybody to really help them out. They just want to be to themselves, think over it, and on their own they will come out of it. This also can happen. So it's very subtle, but the idea is that it makes some difference. Some subtle difference it will make. This way or that, positive or negative. Our time is up.